Welcome back to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Thank you so much for joining me today. Hope you're having a good one. Now, if you're partaking in the New York City, New Year's tradition of walking across the Brooklyn Bridge, listen closely to our next guest. A new book that takes a look at how the bridge came to be and the family who created it through image and word. Titled In the Shadow of Genius, The Brooklyn Bridge and Its Creators, photographer Barbara Mensch embarked on a years-long project to photograph this man-made wonder and to learn about its creators, John Washington and Emily Roebling. The culmination of her research includes photographs of parts of the Brooklyn Bridge most people will never see in person, and a thorough account of how this family struggled and ultimately succeeded in the bridge's construction. The New York Times just named it one of the 9 gift books for the discerning New Yorker, and we are thrilled that Barbara is in studio. Hi, Barbara.
Oh, hi, Allison. Thanks for having me.
We're so happy to have you. I was sharing with Barbara that usually when I research and read a book for a guest, I mark up in the margins questions I have, but I couldn't do it to this book. It's so beautiful. I ended up taking pictures of paragraphs because it's just, even the pages with the text, the way it's the composition of the whole book is it's emotional in a way, I feel.
Do you know how happy I am that you said that? Because one of the real struggles in putting a book like this together is marrying contemporary photography with a personal narrative and parts of the historical record. And this is something in general visual artists, photographers don't do. To combine photography and language in a way that creates in the reader and the viewer, they can conjure up their own images vis-a-vis looking at the pictures and reading the words. You hopefully come up with your own personal image of what the story is about.
And I think because so many of us have been on the bridge or seen the bridge or had the bridge in the back of a picture or, you know, broke up on the bridge or got married or fell in love on the bridge. It's a very emotional place, I think, for a lot of New Yorkers.
Yes. And you can also imagine for someone like me who takes my work very seriously, the whole idea of photographing the Brooklyn Bridge, it's the most photographed thing in the world. Probably, or one of the most photographed things in the world. And in the editing process, even though by, you know, certain standards, you know, some of the images that I really liked, I could have or should have put in, I didn't, because every photograph in there, I'm talking about the bridge specifically, had to be something that I felt internally was something unique, something born of the love of the quest, of the research that I did. So in other words, some of the pictures, I'm really deconstructing some of John Roebling's drawings, which I also have in the book. I have a small selection of drawings that have never been published, or if some of them were, they were done in such a way where you really don't pay much attention to them.
All right.
Am I being a little too...
I love it. I love your descriptions.
It's well, just, I can look. It's too bad that it's only 20 minutes. Really. Because I'm from Brooklyn and we could just talk all day.
We've got time. So as part of your project, you in the beginning, you write a little bit about how you've looked at the bridge and you've been a New Yorker for a long time. Before you started this project, how did you look at the bridge?
Well, it has to really start with... two things. Number one, I moved into the South Street area, the waterfront, and my book that I published before, South Street, was really about my first experiences in the neighborhood as a young artist. You know, living in a place that was almost mythic, because the whole saga of the waterfront, of the tough guy, of mafia, of all of it, this was all sort of part of the mystique of moving into a very desolate area of Manhattan, which had virtually very few people living there, only some artists living in the lofts and in the warehouses. But clearly, if you live next to the Brooklyn Bridge and you're a visual person, it has to impact you. So I come from a drawing and painting background, and my whole life I've been committed to really trying to understand and deconstruct I hate to use this word, brilliance. And and clearly, some of my heroes included Monet, Cezanne, Hiroshige, who was this famous Japanese artist who used to depict Mount Hiroshige over and over and over again. And of course, we all know that Cezanne had, I don't even know how many paintings of Mount Saint-Victoire. And of course, we have Monet, who also would repeatedly paint the same subject, sometimes
so many
in
water
one
lilies.
Day. Yes, but also he was very invested in understanding and capturing how the light changes from day to night. So therefore, you could look at a painting of haystacks at sunrise, at sunset. So, and also in so many other areas of creative thinking, the whole idea of repetition has become a mainstay of an artist's psychology. And, you know, we only have to look to Beethoven, Bach, you know, and it's this repetitive music, you know, the melodies come back and back and back. So for me, it was only natural that the externals, the experience of living next to the Gothic towers, would intrigue me every day. And, you know, and I would love to watch the light over the river, you know, because it was, you know, the East River is like 5 seconds from my door. And, you know, so all of these experiences for an artist, you know, for become part of your life. They're like, they're just, they get into your DNA almost. And even now, you know, years later, it took me a long time to put this project together. You could hear in my voice, I'm still excited. I'm still passionate because the experience of living there, you know, was so inspirational. And one last thing I have to say to answer your first question.
Okay.
Is that one of the things about the bridge, and also I may say this about the Cincinnati Bridge also, because that's in the book, that the Roeblings designed these bridges to endure. It was an engineering feat, each one, where we look today at a lot of different architectural wonders, and this one has survived over the long haul. Major floods, catastrophic floods, hurricanes, snowstorms. So it, to me, that really says something more remarkable about the structures in addition to the beauty.
We're speaking with Barbara Mensch. The name of her book is In the Shadow of Genius, The Brooklyn Bridge and Its Creators. So in the beginning of the book, we are treated to photographs of the inside of the bridge. And in 1999, you got access, we'll put it that way, to the inside of the bridge. Explain to folks how that started and then how you went about getting the permission to use these photographs.
Oh, well, well, this is another story. And just again, since the bridge was right outside my window, I could see every day certain, you know, all the goings on. And one day, this door that is on the side of the anchorage, and for all those the approach, for all those that aren't aware of the approach, when you're on your car, you're on your bike, or you're walking, it's those stone structures that lead up to the span. So on the sides of the stone structures, there are these metal doors that for years have remained shut. So one day I'm walking home with my groceries, and all of a sudden one of the metal doors is ajar. And, you know, so I put everything down and, you know, went, you know, closer to the door and pried it open. And it was almost like I tried to imagine I was, you know, back in Egypt, you know, with the European, with the English archaeologists. And I felt like there was something tomb-like about it. It was dark and musty, and yet at the same time, there was no one there. But that soon changed because in the following weeks, the bridge started to get a lot of considerable press about certain problems, certain repairs that needed to be done, particularly on the approach onto the bridge on the Manhattan side. So as a result, I started seeing construction workers move in trailers. And you have to remember that this whole area was very desolate and filled with a lot of cast-off things, including the homeless, which was really part of the story of those spaces. So I, of course, as a curious person, you know, really wanted to find a way to get in there. So, of course, in the end, I had to lobby the city and convince them. I had to bring a portfolio of photographs up to one of the big offices. And I was like lobbying, you have to let me in there because this is part of the historical record. And or at the time, I just felt relentless about it. It was just important because I knew there was secrets in there or things I wanted to know. And so once I was in, that really changed the whole trajectory of my experiences with the bridge and then creating this book.
One of the more interesting things in the book, there's many interesting things. It is interesting in the book that you choose to go back to Roebling's hometown.
Oh my God,
in
yes.
Germany.
Yes, in Deutschland, yes. Mühlhausen.
What was it that made you decide, I need to travel to Germany to see where this man is from, the original Roebling?
Yeah, well, here's the thing, again, with this book. It's about tracking, trying to identify what are the characteristics, what are the traits. How can we define genius? Now, you have to go to the back of the book to actually find what I came up with. But Mr. Roebling's life was colored by his early experiences in Germany, and not only as an immigrant, as someone, the immigrant story, of course, very much in the news now, but also because I wanted to understand better what his early influences were. And German history, particularly of that period, is more than captivating, more than exciting, because he grew up in what I call like the duck soup of brilliance, starting with, and very eventful, starting with, for our purposes, Martin Luther and the Reformation. The experience of learning about German history, all the brilliant minds that came out of that area, including Goethe and Hegel, who became one of his lecturers. He became one of his professors. And one of the important things to know about his early life, besides the influence of the great architecture in that town, and he happened to grow up. He was born 5 feet away from this beautiful church called the Divi Blasius, which it took 100 years to build. And I got the keys to go in there, just like I did in the Brooklyn Bridge. They gave me the keys, and I, you know, and I spent a few days in there trying to understand what, you know, all the experience of being in a church. And most likely the family, people who lived in that town had to interact with these structures all day, every day, particularly, you know, people of that time would go to the church, not only to worship, but, you know, for all kinds of community events. It served as a real, it had different purposes. But Hegel, getting back to his schooling, so at the University of Berlin, Hegel was very influential, not only to him, but to most of the young people, because at that time we had just experienced the French Revolution, Europe was in chaos, and he instilled in Roebling somehow, some way, this idea that you had to trust in yourself, but more than trust in your own ideas, it was like you had to be intractable in doing that. That if you were coming up with some assumption, some conclusion, something that you discovered, that you had to stick to it no matter what, no matter what anyone says. And in terms of understanding Hegel, which is an incredibly complex, how can I explain this? It's an impossible thing to explain in a few minutes. Mm. But his basic thrust for his students was the concept of freedom and to find freedom in your independent thoughts. That is what put the father, John, on a trajectory to find his own voice vis-a-vis his work.
How do we see that in the Brooklyn Bridge?
Well, okay. First of all, it's quite obvious that the towers with their Gothic structure, their Gothic form, is the most identifying factor in the experience. However, what I talk about in the book and what I show in the book is that artists' work don't just come out of, you don't just create something, you don't have the germ, the seed of a great idea. There's usually stepping stones to that. So one of the things that I discovered going all around to, you know, these different sites where some of the relics of his early projects were, was that you could see the magnificence and the brilliance in how each project that he designed, mostly with very little support and in initially putting up his own funds, you start to understand the struggles that you can identify with as an artist. Mm-hmm. But his story is also colored with a lot of madness. He was a manic. He was driven. He had a fear of death. He completely tortured his family. And at the same time, the story just abruptly ends with his death, and therefore the whole responsibility of Mr. Roebling's life and carrying on his successes fell to the firstborn son, who was cursed, literally cursed, with the responsibilities of his father.
But he sees it through. Washington sees it through.
Yes, and that, again, I have all these photographs from Gettysburg because I really felt that was the highlight of his young life, mm-hmm. in separating from his father, where he finally started to find his own voice as a reliable, responsible Union soldier. And of course, there's the whole backstory, which I'd love to get into, because we really have to talk about Emily, because in the end, she's the real deal.
Let's bring in Emily, because we have a few more minutes.
Oh, no, I can't stay for another.
That means, but this thing is, people will go buy your book now so they can learn the rest. But I'm with you. I want to tell people who you are. We're speaking with Barbara Mensch. The name of her book is In the Shadow of Genius, The Brooklyn Bridge and Its Creators. Let our listeners know about Emily Roebling's contribution.
So one of the things that, the most important thing that people have to understand is that Emily Roebling was one of our true early feminists. And the experiences, which must have been horrifying, and the record on her life in the period that she was dealing with her sick husband, and I quite am confident that the caisson's disease was not the only thing that turned him into somewhat of a recluse, although
the caissons being the foundations of the bridge, and a lot of people got sick.
Because it was underwater, but well, of course, for this talk, it's impossible to get into that. However, it's more important that we understand that Emily lived during the Gilded Age, where women had the same rights as cows in the field. So if we can try and imagine that her need, her stamina to defend and protect her husband during a period where everything was almost covert. I mean, keeping Washington's illness very close to, I don't know how to say it, like it was not
secret. They didn't want anyone to know.
Yeah, like it was not very, I mean, the papers started, you know, there were all these reasons why the press started getting very concerned because they never saw him at the bridge, and she would kind of go down there, and, you know, clearly the press and media haven't changed much. You know, everyone wants to know what the story is. But the point is about Emily is that it's what she did after the bridge was built. Mm-hmm. Okay. And this is where the story gets really amazing. She sought an independent life for herself. And even though it was a little too early for the women's right to vote, she also was involved in all these women's clubs and women's issues, and she traveled alone to Europe. Her husband was not interested in accompanying her. She wanted to see the mm-hmm. world. She met the Queen of England. She went to visit the Tsar on his coronation. She put up her own money to help soldiers coming back from the Spanish-American War. She helped build a hospital in Montauk. I mean, the list goes on and on of all the things that she did. And unfortunately, she died before Washington, who remarkably recovered mm-hmm. and remarried later on in his life. But she was just overworked. I mean, they were all workaholics, and you have to take that into consideration when we think about genius or making great art.
I think a lot of people who listen to this interview will look at the Brooklyn Bridge a little bit differently now. The book is beautiful. The great stories, great information about the Roebling family.
Thank
Barbara
you.
Mensch, her new book is In the Shadows of Genius, The Brooklyn Bridge and Its Creators. Coming up next, we'll talk to singer-songwriter Liz Mitchell, as well as her husband Dan Littleton and their daughter Story. Stay with us. All of it will be back after a quick break. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. In the 1990s, singer-songwriter Elizabeth Mitchell and her husband and bandmate Dan Littleton were in a successful indie band called Ida. The couple began making children's music around the time their daughter Story was born. Fast forward a few years, and Story began to join them on stage when she was little. Fast forward again, and now Story's a teenager. And Liz and Dan and Story are a full-on family band. Over the years, Liz Mitchell became a Smithsonian Folkways recording artist and was the first new children's music artist signed to Smithsonian Folkways in the 21st century. Say that five times fast. She's also earned a couple of Grammy nominations along the way, including for this album, Little Seed, Songs for Children by Woody Guthrie. Take a listen.
Who's my pretty baby? Who's my pretty little baby? You're my pretty little baby. Hey, hey, pretty baby. Hey, hey, pretty baby. Ho, ho, pretty little baby. You're my pretty little baby. Hey, hey, pretty baby.
Liz, Dan, and Story are set to perform at Symphony Space on the Upper West Side tomorrow morning at 11 a.m. Liz also has a new album out. It's a collection with Argentinian musician Suni Paz. It's called Tu Eres Mi Flores, Songs for Children. In Spanish, it came out earlier this year on Smithsonian Folkways. Liz, Dan, and Story are in studio. I'm so happy to see you guys. And I got a little bit nervous in that intro because, full disclosure, we're friends.
I went
to the baby shower for you, Story. So
it
it's, I can talk to other people. My friends come on and I get all nervous and jumbly.
Man.
So let's, I'm going to interview you like we don't know each other.
Okay.
Dan and Liz.
Hi.
Hi. So you guys started making music together in the 90s as Ida had a release of critically acclaimed albums. And when you look back on that time, what do you remember about that time being really great as musicians? And then what about that time was really challenging?
Well, you know, we were on a label called Simple Machines, which was an amazing, you know, I would call them punk, you know, label for me, you know, coming from the music world that I was coming from. I was like, these people are so just really forward thinking and bold and brave, you know, not like expecting some, you know, major label, you know, castle on the hill to come along and create who you were. So I was really excited to enter into this new world of musicians who were just doing it their own way. And that was
AKA my old friends.
Exactly, Daniel's old friends. So it was all new for me, old for him. But I was thrilled. And so when we began touring, you know, we went out with Miggy for the first time, what was it, 1994? It was all new. It was just a really exciting time. And, if you want to say something.
No, I just want to say, because we were kind of talking about it on the way down, which is that it was like an interesting time to just kind of make something and figure out who you were without everything being so visible. And, you know, like every band that starts their first show is on YouTube. Like
nowadays,
like
young
kids, like any band, like it's harder to just kind of mess up and figure out who you are on the road and, you know, find kind of like local scenes by just going into the country. Mm-hmm. And yeah. Traveling around, it's
so
a little
harder.
So that time
might have been the last gasp, you know, yeah. Of that kind of more, you had to be there, personal experience. So it was really, I don't know, it was pretty
cool.
Magic. Thinking about what I'm doing now with children's music, like I had been a teacher at the time, and so I had to leave that to tour. And there was a part of me that missed that, you know, that part of life. And so I was happy when we made this record, You Are My Flower, and that kind of brought us back to that other love of mine, which was working with kids.
She recorded a tape of the songs that are on You Are My Flower at the very beginning of Ida, like when she was a teacher. Like
yeah,
I went
we
in and recorded
with
her with the kids. So you were like already doing it when we started. We started our band and we started going out on the road. You were like working with kids.
Yeah, they already started.
Yeah. So when did you start bringing Story on the road with you?
I think she was, it was like January, so she was maybe 5 months old. We went out to Detroit and played a show.
I had a show.
Beautiful art gallery. There's such a like thriving scene in Detroit. I'm sure there is still now, but back then it was really, really something. And so that was her first road trip was 5 months old.
Now, Story, you said you did not want to talk much, but I have to ask you one question to prove you're here.
Okay.
What's your first memory of being on stage?
What's my first memory of being on stage? That is a hard question. I can't really remember the first time because, as you said, my first road trip with you guys on the road was when I was 5 months old.
Your first performance, you were three. Do you remember that?
Maybe. I remember being pulled off the stage by an audience member who thought I was a fan.
Well, your first performance, you were three. We were in Seattle.
Uh-huh.
And we set up a little chair for you. We were like, do you want to do this? I'm just going to put a little chair and you can sit there and do whatever you want. And do you know who was in the audience that day?
Who?
Ann Powers.
No way.
Yeah.
Oh,
Ann
so
Powers,
cool.
For people who don't know, is a super, super amazing rock writer and rock critic. She's written many books.
Whose story absolutely reveres so much. She quoted her in a zine that she published last year.
Yes.
And she was there with her daughter. It was really special.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
So you said you've been doing this sort of children's music sort of just as something you like to do while you were in Ida. Mm-hmm. When did you realize you were going to transition and that was going to be your future professionally for a while at least?
I think, when we put out that first record, You Are My Flower, it had such an impact. It was so unexpected because we didn't even really release it. And then people were just sort of, you know, word of mouth, giving it as gifts to people. And we got such a strong response. You know, you spend 3 years making an album and you mm-hmm. give it to someone and they say, oh, thank you. And then you spend 1 day on a record and you give it to someone and they go, whoa, okay, this, you know. There's something about children's music when it's done right, it really is like service. You know, you're mm-hmm. giving someone something they can use every day. And so that when that happened, the initial response to the first record, we kind of went, okay. And then it was really when Story was born and we started, you know, integrating her into the creation of what we did, that it seemed like, well, this might allow us to continue a musical life and a family life. And that seemed like something to do at that time.
Dan, being a dad, what impact did that have on you as you started to make this music?
Well, I probably had some struggle with just kind of just all the things that were going on because we were just road dogs. We were like constantly on the road. So then there was the absence of that. And I think that, you know, there's all the elation of starting a family. And then there's like the ungroundedness of what are we going to do? How are we going to make this work? And we ended up just kind of writing a lot and making projects together. And I think it ended up being super exciting, and all these doors started opening up for us. And, you know, that was kind of pivotal, because when Smithsonian Folkways contacted Liz, it just kind of opened up a floodgate of interest. And then suddenly just things started changing. We could, you know, tour less and play more like locally and satellite around
moving
our
moving to Woodstock was
town.
A big part of that too.
And, you know, and then there were also different kinds of gigs than the ones that Ida would play. They weren't like punk clubs and all ages shows in one way. They were all ages shows,
Saturday
but they
morning.
Were at museums.
All ages.
know, or like, you know,
12 months or whatever.
Bigger community centers and things like that. And
yeah, it's nice.
It did. It was like a life change. A good one.
When did you realize your daughter had inherited your talent? Because you never know with the gene pool.
I know.
Wouldn't that have been odd if she
right?
had?
Well, it was funny. I mean, we were kind of relieved because, you know, you have a child and you're like, okay, maybe my life is going to be soccer now. Okay, I'll be all right with that if that happens. But, you know, I was kind of relieved that that didn't happen because I don't, it was beautiful. But also we kept, you know, throughout her childhood, I would encourage her. I would, because she loved to read. You know, she's an avid Harry Potter fan, and she just always had a book right in front of her, like her grandfather. Like, she'd be crossing the street with her face buried in a book. And so I'd say, you know, you could study comparative literature. You don't have to do what mom and dad do. But I tried, you know, to make her feel free, and I hope that you did.
Of course.
But it was when, you know, it's really the moment where when she would just join in on a third part harmony.
Yeah.
Without
one time
being
we were
taught.
Going, we were doing a show with Natalie Merchant, and you were like 7 or 8, something like that.
A little bit.
And we did some like old kind of gloom and doom
Bill Monroe
song. And so we were doing these two part harmonies.
Walls of Time. And then she just started singing.
And she just hit the third part.
And we were like, okay.
And then we did it at the gig, and she was totally the high point of our set. Like, then we were like, oh, okay. Put the kid to work.
We're speaking with Liz Mitchell, Dan Littleton, and Story Littleton. They're going to be performing tomorrow at Symphony Space at 11 a.m. Can I get you guys to play a tune?
Yes, mm-hmm. I'd love to. We want to do a song from the new record.
Absolutely.
From Tuaresmi Flor. You know, this is a record, again, going back to my days of teaching at Roosevelt Island. This is with my very international population of my classroom. None of the kids, they all spoke different languages, and so we kind of brought in music as the universal language. And I've been thinking recently, what kind of a record would I have loved to have when I was a teacher? And this record that I've made, Tuaresmi Flor, is that record I made with Suni Paz. This song is called Mantra Nocturna. It's originally called Night Mantra. It's really a mantra that Renee and Jeremy wrote, a beautiful duo from Los Angeles, Renee Stahl and Jeremy Toback. We'll sing it for you now.
Yo seré tu casa, yo seré tu guía, siempre a tu lado. Yo seré tu amiga, duerme en tu cama, en la noche quieta, rodeada de luna, hasta que abra el día. Yo seré tu casa, yo seré tu guía, siempre a tu lado. Yo seré tu amiga, duerme en tu cama, en la noche quieta, rodeada de luna, hasta que abra el día. Yo seré tu guía, siempre a tu lado. Yo seré tu amiga, duerme en tu cama, en la noche quieta, rodeada de luna, hasta que abra el día. Yo seré tu casa, yo seré tu guía, siempre a tu lado. Yo seré tu amiga, duerme en tu cama, en la noche quieta, rodeada de luna, hasta que abre el día.
That's Liz Mitchell, Dan Littleton, and Story Littleton from the new album Tu Eres Mi Flore, Songs for Children in Spanish. That's such a lovely idea that you thought that this is something I would love to have had as a tool, as a teacher.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, so much of my time, you know, of course I taught the children songs. I sat there with my guitar. I let them try playing the guitar, and we would sing John the Rabbit and, you know, all of those Woody Guthrie, One Day, Two Day, 3 Days Old. But there was also the time during lunch when I would put on a record, you know, and they would listen, and it would be so calming and focusing and grounding and beautiful. And it was usually Rafi. Like, I love Rafi. Mm-hmm. But I thought, well, what if, you know, this time when they're listening is also this kind of passive learning time. And putting on a record with songs that they mostly would already know in English, in this language that for some of them wasn't their first language. And so they'd be absorbing vocabulary because they'd be making those mm-hmm. connections, whether it's You Are My Sunshine, You Are Tu Eres Mi Sol, or whatever song, Row Row Your Boat, you know, it's one we're going to do tomorrow, Rema 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 El Bote. So I had always thought, well, that's a moment, you know, that's like a moment where I could be sneaking in some knowledge, and in addition to this like beautiful grounding service that music can provide when you're working with children. And so, yeah, it was an idea for a long time. You know, Suni and I started it in 2010.
Wow.
She lives out in Nevada, and it kind of had to, she would come and visit and we would work. But during that time since, I think I released 4 other albums. You know, I made this Christmas album and Woody Guthrie and Blue Clouds and an album with Dan Zanes. So it was kind of whenever we could get Suni to come and visit, we would knock out a couple more songs. And I'm really glad that we waited as long as we did, because it had evolved in a beautiful way. And I think this is a good time to be releasing mm-hmm. an album in Spanish. You know, I think we need it right now. So, yeah.
I'm sort of, you mentioned Dan Zanes, and I'm curious, as parents, you know, I always thought, oh, God, am I going to have to, like, listen to Barney endlessly?
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden there was this explosion of really good music mm-hmm. that happened to be geared towards children.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think happened? Is it that we all started becoming parents, our generation?
Well, I think so. I think that this generation of, you know, we're all music lovers, and we want to share that with our kids, you know, and we don't, and we, like, I don't know exactly what it is, but I've always thought that that was part of it, of wanting to share. There's something about rock and roll that's so youthful, you know, and that kids can tap into maybe better than we can, you know, even children. So I think there was something of that, like not wanting to be there to be a divide mm-hmm. between, you know, your life as a musician and your life as a parent, like really wanting to integrate it. Mm-hmm. And I'm so glad that it happened. You know, I mean, back then, and I made my first album in 1998, 20 years ago, and there weren't many. I did not have peers.
Yeah.
That I knew of. I'm sure I did, but I didn't have ones that I knew of. And then I remember when Story was born in 2001 and reading an article about this guy named Dan Zanes who was doing shows over in Chelsea. And I was like, whoa,
and
cool.
He was in the Del Fuegos, yeah. Kind of a punk hillbilly band.
So I sought him out. I went to see him play, like, right, you know, October 2001. And we met, and we were so excited to meet each other and be like, you do this weird thing too? Awesome. And then it wasn't too long before other people sort of figured out that it was such a, like, beautiful thing to do. And it just grew.
So tomorrow... Oh, go ahead, Dan.
No, I was just going to say that Liz always has said something that I really appreciated also, which is that, because you didn't specifically, you wanted to work with children and you always embraced that approach, but you also talked about, like, it's for children, like there's a children's book literature tradition.
Yeah, I thought about
and
it
like
that
people
way. Great
like
children's literature,
people enjoy it like at all ages and take it at its mm-hmm. on its own just as like an art form, and children's music, maybe it's not so much
Well, there was like a little time where you wanted to call yourself family music and not children's music.
Oh, that's interesting.
And I was like, I think I make children's music. I mean, it is for
but
the whole
But we were like,
family,
you know, Jonathan Richman and the Velvet Underground and Elizabeth Cotton are all children's music.
You have the coolest parents. You have to know that. Okay, so tomorrow at Symphony Space at 11 a.m., it's a holiday show. You've done this holiday show before.
We have,
Can you explain to folks what they can expect tomorrow?
Well, they can expect a real range. You know, everybody's definition of the holidays is different, so we try to keep it very broad, and we'll be singing Jingle Bells, which is honestly was on our first album. That's how you know that our first album was not intended for release, because in the middle of this record of, like, folk covers,
completely
we sing
random,
Jingle Bells. Because it really was meant to be a Christmas present just
like
for our
Johnny
nieces
Cash
and
bootleg.
Nephews. So we'll be doing that and a couple of other holiday songs, but then really just our old favorites and then songs from this new record as well.
Story, do you keep your parents up on what's popular now?
Do you have I to do, but they keep up on it as well on their own. They really do. They make a point to keep up with new music.
We do. We love Ariana Grande's new song.
They do.
Just for the record.
Yeah.
That's your carpool karaoke in
the
family. Going down
at the
Route 28.
Yes, thank you.
Beautiful.
Next. It is.
She plays it just on the piano, like kind of quiet and sad, and it holds up.
Can we get you to play one more song before we let you go?
Yes.
Take this
to
break.
So we're going to sing one of our most favorite songs. It's called Peace Like a River. We end pretty much every concert with this song. I kind of can't leave a show until we played this song. It's a little bit my moment of trying to do mind control on everyone around me, just to get them to, like, believe that they have peace like a river in their soul. Like these children, I hope that, you know, 10 years from now, you'll be in a moment of conflict and you'll just remember, oh, wait, I've got peace like a river in my soul. I'm good. I know what to do right now. It's my hope.
All right, you can do it to the entire listening audience.
Right? So you
get ready for the mind.
Peace like a river in your soul, but I'm going to sing it in Spanish today.
Excellent.
Paz como un río. Okay, here we go. Siento paz como un río, siento paz como un río, siento paz como un río en mi alma. Siento paz como un río, siento paz como un río, siento paz como un río en mi alma. Siento amor como el mar, siento amor como el mar, siento amor como el mar en mi alma. Siento amor como el mar, siento amor como el mar, siento amor como el mar en mi alma. Siento alegría como un fuente, alegría como un fuente, alegría como un fuente en mi alma. Siento alegría como un fuente, alegría como un fuente, alegría como un fuente en mi alma. Siento paz como un río, siento paz como un río en mi alma. Siento paz como un río, siento paz como un río, siento paz como un río en mi alma. Siento paz como un río en mi alma.
You can see Liz Mitchell, Dan Littleton, and Story Littleton tomorrow at 11 a.m. at Symphony Space. Definitely all ages. Thanks, guys, for coming to the studio.
Thanks,
and being
Allison.
On all of it. It's so good to see you. This is All of It. We'll be back after a quick break. You're listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart, and it is Friday, which means it's that time of the week on All of It when we sort through what's happening around town with the help from our colleague, Charlie Heumann. We call it Charlie for the Culture. Charlie joins at the moment. And Charlie, we brought some help along.
We brought some help along today.
We're going to do some staff picks. Our senior producer, Rosie, is here to recommend a holiday concert by the Ghostlight Chorus. Hi, Rosie.
Hi, Allison. Yeah, I wanted to recommend this group and this performance. They do an annual holiday performance, which is really beautiful, and they do it at the Church of St. Luke's in the Fields, and that's downtown, and this year it's called Stars. It's on Sunday, December 8th, and it's at 7:30 p.m. The business end of things is that tickets are available on their website, ghostlightchorus.com, and available at the door. It's a beautiful, elite chamber choir, and they just do a whole range of different music over, I mean, from 16th century to 21st century. They're doing a piece, actually, by Eric Whitaker this year,
who Clemmie mentioned on Monday.
It's called Lux Aurumque, and it's really, really beautiful. And then at the end of the concert, every holiday concert that they do a sing-along of all of your beloved Christmas carols, and they do a little festive wine and cocktail cookie reception after.
Excellent. Ursula Summer is here, one of our producers, to recommend a PS1 issue. Sunday session? What's going on?
Exactly. So last Sunday, I decided to go to PS1 Sunday sessions because my roommate had actually done some tech design for Sarah Kinlaw, who's a composer, choreographer, and artist, and she was commissioned to create a one-time piece in the museum's dome. It's titled Unboxing the Compass, Bending the Axis. And her piece incorporated dance, live vocalizations, and really a wide range of microphones on stage, which amplified the sounds of the choreography. So this is part of an ongoing series that PS1's been doing since 2012, which is sponsored by VW. And every Sunday, a new performance or event is featured. It includes artists, scholars, activists, and cultural figures. And they can present both finished works as well as works in progress. This Sunday, a gallery talk presented in conjunction with MoMA's current exhibition, Bruce Nauman, Disappearing Acts, will be led by both John Miller and Ora Rosenberg. And what I really love about this series is how it defines live events in the broadest of terms, including dance, performance art, music, and as well, artist talks, making each Sunday really a unique one-time happening.
You did really well. I can see your hand is shaking. You did a great job, Ursula. Okay, Charlie, you're up.
Alrighty.
What's our first?
So I want to bring to people's attention this show that's at the Park Avenue Armory called The Head and the Load. So earlier this week, John Schaefer, who is the host of WNYC's New Sounds, he reported a piece on this, and I was the editor for him on this story. And this is a presentation. It's sort of a multimedia discipline, disciplinary show that is about the nearly 2 million Africans who served in World War I in Africa as porters for basically the European colonists, that you have the French and the English battling the Germans through their colonies in Africa, and they brought these Africans to be their porters. And it comes from a Ghanaian proverb that has to deal with the weight that was borne on the head and the shoulders. Many of these men died in the war, and they were really fighting for a cause that was not their own.
And what was the proverb?
Well, the proverb is the head and the load are the troubles of the neck. And, you know, what's fascinating is what they're trying to do in this production is bring to your attention a story that you may not know, that a lot of people may not know a lot of these details. And we're at the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I. And what we have right now is the story where we don't have a lot of details. It's very fragmented. A lot of it was not recorded. There was very much this idea of lest their actions merit recognition, their deeds must not be recorded. So really, we don't know a lot about it. So the way they go about creating it, I mean, how do you create a show like that? It is that they do it through collage, through, you know, it's not a straightforward narrative because there may not be a very straightforward narrative.
Not a through line.
A particular through line. So, you know, that's why they're using things like music and dance. There's the Knights, which is an orchestra based in Brooklyn that performs. There are projected animations. And the creator of this is William Kentridge, who is South African himself and has done operas and theater and drawings. And one of the things that he is very interested in is exploring colonialism and the legacy of apartheid. And so in this show, what he's looking at in particular really is language and how do we communicate with one another? How do we express ideas. And you remember coming out of World War I, one of the big art movements was Dada, which was this illogical language, this idea of how could logic lead to World War I and all the deaths that happened in it. So this is a show that's really trying to explore a history that we don't know much about. It's a really interesting one. They're really involved with students. It's a show definitely to check out.
All right. Charlie, you always bring us something interesting. Charlie Herman, thank you so much. Rosie and Ursula, thank you so much. For you listening, thank you so much. We'll see you next week.